بإذن الله.
Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, they say for our kuzri is this incredible blend of mind and heart and neshama. And we'll let Hashem speak to the many different machshava interests in this room. And hopefully to speak to yet another interest to focus particularly in the world of tefillah. Because of which we're going to be soon turning our attention in particular to the third section, the third mamar of Sefer HaKuzri, but I think we ought to introduce the Sefer HaKuzri just a drop before we dive in. I think I mentioned Yehuda HaLevi is from the earliest period of the Rishonim. Just to put it into context, the Rambam probably was well familiar, as Yitzchak Shelat points out, with the Sefer HaKuzri. Rambam's father, Rabbi Maimon, was a Talmud of the Rimagash, who was the Rambam tells us in the Hakdam Pirush Mishnah, Rimagash was an incredible super genius. Sichlo mavis b'chol ha-Talmud, Rambam writes at the end of the Hakdam Pirush Mishnah. The man had a scary mind. His seichel was frightening. He was frighteningly brilliant throughout Shas. And the Rimagash was the prime Talmud of the Rif. And the Rimagash was the Rebbe, not only Rabbi Maimon, but also Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. Rabbi HaLevi, who is famous less for his work in Gemara, and more for his work in the world of Machshava, expressed both in verse and poetry. There are many famous, more famous and less famous poems. All the piyutim of Tzion at the end of the Kinos. Tzion HaLotishali, the whole series of Tzion Kinos. So those are all written by Yehuda HaLevi. And Yehuda HaLevi also did much work in the world of Machshava, and you can either call it the prose or drama, because he wrote this very important Sefer HaKuzari, dialogue, as a dramatic dialogue between a series of players. And what we're going to, as I mentioned, our focus, at least initially, is going to be what Yehuda HaLevi has to say about Avoda in general, and Tefillah in particular, and that's the beginning of the third Mamar. But to contextualize things a little bit, I want to start by looking at the very, very beginning, just to sort of get the frame. Because all of his conversations about Ikari Amuna, again, he's roughly, like I was saying before, he's roughly a contemporary of Rambam's father, which would be like next in Sfarad, which means just to sort of the Ashkenaz parallels, he's roughly a contemporary, right? The Rif and Rashi were contemporaries. See, he's roughly a contemporary of the first or second generation of Baal HaTosis. You're thinking Rabbi Natan, Rabbi Natan's nephew, Rabbi Nubarach. But the early Baal HaTosis are at work in France and to an extent in Germany. Yehuda HaLevi is operating around the same time in Spain and ultimately makes his way eastward towards Eretz Yisrael. So I want to take a look at the opening frame, because the Sefer HaKuzri is a work of historical fiction, or the framework of Sefer HaKuzri. The content is Machshava, but the framework that he uses to present it, let's take a look together. And just a word about what you have. We're jumping a couple of pages in. First, the page looks like this. I'll explain the first couple pages of the packet after. The page has a number 10, number 11. Ma'amar Rishon. This edition that I'm sharing with you is known as the Kuzri HaMefurash, put up by Rabbi Mordechai Genizi, because the Sefer HaKuzri was originally written, as were most of the Sephardi Sifrei Machshav of the Rishonim, was written in Arabic and was translated by members of the Ibn Tibbon family into Hebrew. So, right away, you're not going to see Yehuda HaLevi in the original, like most of the Rambam's writings, like Chovas HaLevavos. Translated into a Hebrew that's sort of artificial. They had this style. Most of what we have, except for Mishnah Torah, everything else is in translation. Mordechai was written in Arabic. Perash Mishnayos is written in Arabic. Mishnah Torah is written in Hilchos such and such. Mishnah Torah, that was written in Hebrew originally by the Rambam. Almost everything else that we have from the Rambam, almost everything else, is written in Arabic and translated into Hebrew. So everything in the translation, goes up to some translators are better, some translators are less capable. But also, even if you have a very capable translator, and the Ibn Tibbon family in particular, they sort of kept the Arabic style. style, the Arabic sentence structure. You know, when you speak to someone who's not a native English speaker and is trying to have a conversation with you in English, so often not only are there sometimes the words that are missing, but like your sentence structure, or if you've tried with your broken Hebrew to converse with an Israeli, you don't realize the extent to which you are, not only the words don't always fit, but you're trying to impose like English sentence structure with Hebrew words. It doesn't always flow so well. So sometimes you have translations of the Rishonim from Arabic to Hebrew, so sometimes the language gets a little choppy. So if Mordechai Genizi did, so there are translations, the traditional translation into Hebrew, there are new translations into Hebrew, there are translations into English. What Mordechai Genizi did, the Kuzri HaMefurush, is it gives you side by side, on the right side of the page, the right-hand page, is the classical translation of the Kuzri. The left-hand page, he redid it into easy, smooth-flowing modern Hebrew. Very, Ivrit Kala, very simple, basic, smooth, sort of a very idiomatic. So let's take a look at the very beginning of Ma'amar Rishon, and then we'll talk about those first couple pages, the mysterious pages in the booklet, including the notes of the Rav, and then we'll be prepared to dive into our core topic, Ma'amar Shlishi. Armi Yehuda ben Shaul. You know? Let's read some of the classical language on page 10. The very opening of Sefer Kuzri. Amar Machaber, the author writes, Sha'ol Sha'olu Yosi Am Moshe Yesh Iti Min Hatanos V'Hatshuvos. I've been asked, says Yehuda Levi, to present what Orthodox Jews have to say in response to HaKolkim Aleinu Min HaPhilosophim V'Anshi HaToros. What do I have to say in response to the claims of the Aristotelian philosophers? What do I have to say? This is a golden age of Spain. What do I have to say in response to Anshei HaToros? Sounds like people of other religions. And, number three, Al Haminim HaKolkim Al Hamon Yisrael, the Apikursim, who reject the tradition and the approach of the Jewish nation. That third group is, the first group is a response to philosophy, which had, at that point was, this is during the Middle Ages, was not particularly current in Christian Europe, but in Muslim Europe, in North Africa, in Spain, this was all the rage. So Rabbi Yehuda Levi is trying to respond, number one, to the approaches of Greek philosophy, number two, to other religions, specifically, obviously, Christianity and Islam, and number three, who are these apikursim who reject the approach of Klal Yisrael, Jewish apikursim, carrots. And those who have studied a little bit of medieval Jewish history, you know that the Rambam, just a generation later, is fighting tooth and nail against the Karaites. He shows up in Egypt. I believe he flees Spain, makes it across northern Africa, Eretz Yisrael, then to Egypt. He shows up in Egypt and he discovers that the Hamon Am are mostly Orthodox Jews, but the elite establishment, the intelligentsia, were the Karaites, who had rejected the Torah Shebaal Peh. And the Rambam, that became a major battle, intellectual battle of the Rambam. And it wasn't new. Many generations before, Sajigaon is fighting that Milchemes Hashem. And the generation before the Rambam, the Sefer HaKuzri, at the opening lines, this could be a response to philosophy. What does Orthodox Judaism have to say about the approach of the approaches of Greek philosophy? What do we have to say about the ideas of Christianity and Islam? And how do we respond to the Karaite Apikursis, the rejection of Torah Shebaal Peh? So he says, I was asked to put together, what do we believe? Let's put together, what do we believe? V'zacharti, he says, I remember. Masha shemativ kvar mitainos hachaver asher hoya etz al melech kuza. He says, I remember hearing, and here's where he launches into, again, a literary device, the historical fiction, in the sense that he's going to use a story to present the content as absolutely authentic content. He says, I remember hearing about this chaver. A chaver in the language of Mishnayos is a very religious, a Talmud Chacham, a rabbi. I remember hearing about the ideas, the arguments presented by the rabbi, the chaver, asher hoya etzel melech kuzar, who spent time with the king of the Khazars, Hanichnas Bedas HaYehudim, who the king of the Khazars, who converted to Judaism, Hayom Ka'arba Me'oshanim, around 400 years ago, Kasher nizgar v'node b'sifrei divayim. As is described, as is mentioned in the history books. This is a fascinating, and what Rehu Levi did is he takes this story, which I think I mentioned to some of you, there's been research done recently by historians, it's actually a PhD dissertation done at Yale 2-3 decades ago, on this story, and he discovered, this historian discovered a lot of, a fair amount of evidence to back up this story, that in the probably 8th century, 7th century, 8th century, there was in Central Asia, what's now the former Soviet Union, one of the stans, Kazakhstan maybe, Uzbekistan, somewhere in that area, of Caucasia, that there was this tribe called the Khazars who taught mysteriously, converted to Yahdis, and apparently had a sovereign Jewish nation in the somewhere in the in or around the Caucasian mountains for possibly a couple of centuries until they were overrun by marauders. So the Yehuda Levi shows that story. Try to imagine. That's a fascinating story. Again, apparently there's a lot, fair amount of historical evidence to back this up. So you got to wonder, like, what happened? In the middle of nowhere. It's not like you have a non-Jew who grows up in a Jewish neighborhood. So he'll be exposed to Yahdus. We understand he's exposed to Yahdus. And perhaps he'll decide this is something that the way he wants to live his life. You got to wonder, a tribe out in some remote mountainous area become, and the whole nation became Jewish. Kind of wonder, what happened? So Yehuda Levi was apparently very fascinated about this as well. He said, we're going to use this. Let's try to imagine what that conversation was. There must have been conversations between the king and Rabban. Let's try to imagine. And he uses that story as a frame for his entire sefer. Everything he wants to present about Jewish philosophy and Jewish ideas and the reasons behind mitzvahs and what we believe and why we believe and what does Torah and Shemayim mean, and so much, everything is going to fit into that framework. And the entire sefer from this point on is going to be conversations between the king and ultimately between the king and the rabbi. But it begins, we read a couple more lines of the to set the stage, because you got to imagine, when the great Rishonim choosing a story to be a framework for his device, for his magnum opus. This is going to be his signature sefer, a Machshava Sayadus. There must be a lot going into even the framework. This wasn't done just, la-di-da. So what image does he paint for us? And Rav Shalak points out, this is an image, the image itself, the fiction, tells us a lot. He says, Kinishna, here we are at the very end of the fifth one. Page 10. There was a dream that he had. Again, Hishanosa Chalom. Over and over and over, he's having this dream. And it's disturbing. What's the dream? He imagines in the dream, he has a dream as though there's an angel speaking to him in the dream. He hears a voice, he sees a malach in his dream. The more front. Here's the famous one. Kavanasva Ritsuya Eitzel Habori. In the dream, the Malach Uzari again is having this dream again and again. And in the dream, he hears this voice. He hears this angelic voice. And you have to come all this way, just get my heart. And in the dream, he hears this voice. And the message is Kavanasa Ratsuya. You mean well. Your Kavana is acceptable. Kadosh Baruch Hu is thrilled at how you want, but mascha in anurotze. But your masim are not. You mean well, you're good intentions, but you're not executing right. You're doing the wrong thing. He had the dream once. Okay, he had the dream once. Everyone has funny dreams. But it happens again and again and again and again. It starts to concern him. But who are you, mishtadel? What does he do? So he gets the impression, I got to be more religious. Okay, meanwhile, you're a religious guy, religious heart. We would say, you have a Jewish heart, but what are you doing with it, right? So you have a kuzar heart, but you gotta follow through. So his first response is, Hoya mishtadel ma'od betoras ha-kuzar. So he began to do more ishtadlos. We just talked about ishtadlos, right? Let's do more ishtadlos. He starts to work harder at toras ha-kuzar, at whatever the local kuzari pagan religion was. is it. I guess, you know, I feel religious, but I'm not coming to temple enough. I'm not doing what I'm supposed to do. Actually, v'shamesh ba'agodas ha'heichal v'akarbonos bi'atzmo b'leib sholem. This is the king. But he's so distraught over this dream that he starts to throw himself more and more into Kuzari religion, Chazar religious practice, to the extent that he becomes one of the priests. And he himself, the king, the Chor of Yatzmo, takes off his crown, and he's at work slaughtering animals in the Chazar temple because he's having this dream. You got to do more. You mean well, but you got to do more. But it doesn't help. The more he threw himself into that set of activities, that religious practice, it didn't happen. He keeps having the dream, it seems like with even greater frequency, with even greater intensity. So he gets the message, I'm barking up the wrong tree. I'm trying hard, but I'm angry, I'm setting my goal in the wrong place. Now all of a sudden, there's a change of approach. It's not just do what I do, but do it more. Now I have to investigate. Now I have to start thinking. Take a step back and figure out. I have to do some figuring out of what's the right way. And ultimately, he began to investigate different religions, the Emunos and Dasos. The Kuzri's language is precise here, because not everything he investigates is going to be a religion. It'll be a belief system, but the first investigation is actually going to be Greek philosophy. He begins to look at Emunos and Dasos, at different ways of believing, at different religions. The His Yahed Basov. And ultimately, in the end of the story, he becomes Jewish, Lehis Yehei. Where does that become Yehudi? Anyone know? A quick Tanakh Bikis? This is an easy Tanakh Bikis. Where does that Shorash appear in Tanakh? Yehudim. Now Yehudim, but as a verb, to become Jewish, to be Mis Yehei. Where is that? In the Gila? You're right. The right Sefer of Tanakh. In the Gila Zester. Anyone? No? Ah, fantastic. Thank you, Raziel. All right. Rabbi Meir Ha'aretz Misyadim. Remember at the end, the Paraktes, everything, Paraktes, everything after Haman's whole approach comes crashing down, and now Mordechai's in ascendancy? It's exactly what Raziel said. Right? There's tremendous pressure, there's political pressure, there's fright, and loads of people are jumping on the Jewish bandwagon. So here, with a very different angle, because this is not a result of political pressure, as we're going to see. If anything, he's the king. This is entirely, actually by contrast, a result of a real odyssey. Because again, he's the king. No one's the pressure is entirely internal. You think about it, the symbolism, again, like I said before, it's like Shailat reminds us to think about the symbolism of how he sets up the story. The fiction, historical fiction, but the detail, we don't know the detail. We really didn't know the details of the story of the Khazar king set 400 years ago. He doesn't, if you would have asked, he's not actually giving you a real transcript of the conversation. There must have been some conversation. He's going to use it as a framework to present his ideas, Rav Yehuda Levi's ideas on Machshavas Yad. But to appreciate the story, like the story, I think I get it. So part of it is, this is entirely internal. Is it the opposite type of Lehis Yehei? There's no political pressure. He's the king. He can do what he wants. As a matter of fact, he's actually going to bring everyone along with him. The pressure is internal. The push is the message from within. And you see that his first approach is sort of stick within your own backyard and let's be a frumer Chazari. And then he realizes that's not happening. The Malcolm makes it clear that that's not the way to go. So he begins to back up. And he begins to look. So then he writes, Ra'isi Garam Lozeh Lachor Lamuz Ba'adasos. So this pressure, this understanding that the Chazari way is not the right way, causes him to begin to investigate. His Sehepa Sohu Ba'am Rav Yakuzum. Ultimately, he and so many of his subjects are Mishyahei, they convert. V'hoyu Mitayno Sachaber Mashinis Yashva Nafshi Alehim. Is he will like it. He says, a lot of what the rabbi had to say, things that I agree with. That itself is a fascinating line. Because Rav Levi is already saying, just like we're comfortable with machlokas in the area of halacha, we're comfortable with machlokas in the area of machshava and agada too. He says, Again, maybe he really did have access to transcripts from 400 years back, but I think it's usually assumed that he did not, and he wasn't claiming to. So, but this again is another detail. He's presented as, I came across what he said, and I liked a lot of what he said, almost like he's trying to say there can be machlokas in the world of machshava within legitimate, not machlokas to himself and the karet whom he rejected that because machlokas is myself and that's over. Okay, a lot of it I like. So let me present what I agree with. Let me present these ideas. Let me present these conversations. And then you'll gain a lot. Now, again, if we were learning Sefer HaKuzri, if our focus was just to learn Sefer HaKuzri straight, see, we would dive in straight. Let me give you just a little praises of what happens over the course of the next number of 20, 30 pages of the English edition, of the first mamar, the first section. He interviews a new Aristotelian philosopher. He asks him some question what he believes. Speaks to a priest, speaks to an imam, and he's like, yeah, the Jews, they even talk to a Jew, talk to a rabbi. It's a little group. Question, good question.
I was asking about the university philosopher.
Oh. Neo. Neo is a more familiar prefix to some of us from a different type of Neo. The Neo just means new. So whether it's a revival of the best from 200 years ago, and Neo-Hasidim, or Lahavdil Alfei Abdalos, Neo-Aristotelian philosophy was the revival of the philosophy of Aristotle. Aristotle was a Greek philosopher from around the time of the end of the Triassic Age, 2,500 years ago at least, in Greece. But in the Middle Ages, the Arabs of the Middle Ages had sort of this renewed interest in Greek thinking, in Greek philosophy, in Greek science, and there's both the Kuzri and the Rambam are working within that world. As I was saying before, the Baal Tosos, Baal Batim in France or Germany were not interested in, that wasn't part of the culture at the time. In the Middle Ages in France and Germany, in the Christian parts of Europe, no one was really interested in, very few people were interested in Greek thought, in Greek science, and Greek philosophy. In Spain, at that point, Muslim Spain and Muslim Northern Africa, the Arabs were far more sophisticated than the Christians at that point. And this was very much a part of the culture. This was very much, everyone was into, everyone. It was the intelligentsia were very involved in Greek thought, and this was a big issue. The issues of Emunas Vedeus were much more of a struggle among the Sephardim at that point than among the Ashkenazim. The people were reading, and people were thinking, people were trying to figure out, and some people came to healthy conclusions, some people came to religiously unhealthy conclusions. That's exactly why the Sadduceus and a couple of generations later, the Kuzri, Rabbeinu Bachai, and the Rambam were all working heavily on putting together Sefer Machshava to express what's an authentic Torah perspective. That's how he had opened, that we saw before. Right? He said, I want to present responses to Greek philosophy, which had come back into vogue. I want to present responses to Christianity and Islam, and I want to present responses to the Karaites. So over the course of Mamar Rishon, the dramatic tool that he uses to do that is he has the king of the Khuzers say, hey, I don't know, what's the right way, so I'll be the next Yisrael, and let me investigate. So he has this couple of pages of a conversation with a neo-Aristotelian philosopher. And again, a philosopher of the time, but who's presenting the Aristotelian approach to Aristotle. And then he says, okay, I like Tony saying, I don't like other things that you say. And he calls in a priest to talk about Christianity, calls in an imam, or whatever the term was at the time, to discuss Islam. And then he has this line, and says, you should call in a rabbi. Rabbi, the Jews are such a little people, they're so persecuted. What are the chances they have anything good to say? And what's fascinating is the rabbi initially answers his first question. Again, this is not our focus, we're looking inside. We ask, who do you believe? Explain to me your idea of God. So at first, the rabbi says something that the king is very upset by. You're not methodical, you're not logical. And then, sort of like what we saw in the manuscript version of Mesillas Yesharim, the Chacham and the Chassid, first the king thinks he's so smart, and then this rabbi, this chaver, is so shallow and sophisticated. Within a couple of pages, all of a sudden, he realizes the rabbi is many steps ahead. Many, many steps ahead. He begins to appreciate
the nuance of what the Chacham's initial, the Chavra's initial presentation. And most of Ma'amar Rishon is developing what do Jews believe in, what does it mean to believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, what does it mean to believe in Torah, and how do we come to, why is it that we believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we believe in Torah Meshama, and sort of like developing the basics. I believe that the end of Ma'amar Rishon, that's the end of Act 1. And the king says, okay, it's been nice talking to you, and I'm going to go back to my people. I believe Act 2, Ma'amar Sheni, begins with, now we have to have a second meeting. I think the vizier comes to the Mosel. Like, it's sort of like, again, it's sort of a dramatic beginning. And then it gets into Tochen. And finally, at the end of Ma'amar Sheni, he says, I really appreciate what you've developed. And now that I understand sort of Yadus in general, now I want to roll up my sleeves. Let's talk about applications. And that brings us to what we're going to start with. We're going to pick up with tomorrow, Mitzvah Shem. Is the beginning of Ma'amar Shlishi, he sort of lays at the very end of Ma'amar Sheni, here are a couple things I want to talk about. He wants to talk about the Karaites, he wants to talk about this, that. But the first thing he wants to talk about is, what does it mean for a Jew to be an Ovid? Now that I understand sort of Judaism, in the abstract, I understand that you believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Torah and so on and so forth. Let's start applying. Like, we talk about the applied Amunah. Let's apply your beliefs. How is a Jew supposed to worship? Because remember, What was the way that Rabbi Yehuda Levi set it up? Kavanascha Ratzuya, Aval Masecha, Inena Ratzuya. That's very, very important. You could mean well. It's important to mean well. It's also important to do well, to do right. So he says, now they have begin to understand where you're coming from. I understand the basis, I understand the framework. But now, and that's in the packet, we pick up Ma'amar Shlishi. He says, so how does a Jew worship? What's a Jew supposed to do? I'm not asking for a list of mitzvahs. He's asking to understand like the meaningfulness of Avos Hashem. Of what does it mean? What are you supposed to do? And why does it make sense? Over the course of the first couple of paragraphs, first couple of pages, first couple of osios of Ma'amar Shlishi, he's going to be talking about Shabbos Yontif, he's going to be talking about Karbanos, he's going to be talking plenty about Tefillah. So this is going to, it's going to be, again, an approach of mind and heart and neshama, the tefillah, and in a very rich context of understanding what it means deeply, and saying what it means in the context of the overall approach of Yadus. So Bli Neder tomorrow, this is really your introduction to the Sefer Kuzri. Bli Neder tomorrow, we're going to roll up our sleeves and get started with Kuzri on tefillah, and Kuzri on avoda, maybe more general, in Ma'amar Shlishi. Before we put this away, I just want to turn back for a moment to the very beginning, because I had promised you this little bibliographical present. So I think I told you guys the other day that I found this great Sefer HaKuzri in the library. Well, I sort of told some of you that moved. We now see, you now get a sense of how it works a little bit, how it's structured, and it's a conversation. And as is the nature of conversations, like the most famous Sefer written as a conversation is? Okay, that's pretty good. Even more famous than Mishnah is Shir Shirim. Shir Shirim. Torah. Sure, that's not bad. Okay. You would think that we have a Torah Shabbat centered curriculum here, because shockingly, no one mentioned
the Gemara.
Yes, right. Gemara is all a conversation. Right? I like the Shir Shirim. When Pesach comes close, we'll Bli Neder spend at least a day or two on the Malbim's approach to Shir Shirim. For the Malbim, it's very much a conversation or a play in five acts. So, for those of you who are Shir Shirim experts, you may have noticed this in Shir Shirim. I have not. I am neither that nor have I noticed that. But for those of you who have spent some time learning Gemara, at least, you probably noticed the topics often appear more than once over the course of Shas, and it's Chazal comment, Divrei Torah and Yiv Makam Echad Vashir Makam Echad. Often the same topic, Divrei Torah will be poor and Yiv Makam Echad Vashir Makam Echad. Poor in one place and rich somewhere else. And we might be learning Mekash Milva, hypothetically speaking, in Davavah and Beis, you think you start Mesechus Kiddushin, Davavah, here's the sin of Mekash Milva. You ain't see nothing until you see Daf Mem Zayin, and stand there Blachim Boyin Deh until you see Daf Mem Ches also. Right? So you got to look at the whole picture. When you learn Sefer HaKuzri, so over the years, there have been many attempts to sort of reorganize Shas out of conversational order into topical order. Most famously, Rambam, right? The Torah and the Shulchan Torah and Shulchan Aruch. So Rav Chatzkel Sarna of the Chevron Yeshiva in the mid-20th century tried to do the same thing to the Sefer HaKuzri. That's why we have the beginning of this packet, just for you to see. One of the interesting republications of the Sefer HaKuzri is here. Sefer HaKuzri Rabbi Yehuda Alevi, Aruch L'fi Arachim Yuchadim. Reorganized by topics. The very first page. Rav Chatzkel Sarna put out, reorganized by in the 60s. See, Tafshin Chafen. To give you a sense. This was 2 years before the war of 1967. This was 2 years before the Six-Day War. This is in a very narrow strip of Eretz Israel. Chevron was already then, had been ready for many decades in Yerushalayim. And Chatzkel Sarna puts out a Sefer HaKuzri. He says, the Sefer HaKuzri is very hard. The language is hard. And also, like, the whole story piece is beautiful and profound. But sometimes it makes it a little hard to get into, and you come across a topic more than once. So you turn the page, you see what he did. Is he put together organized sort of selections of Sefer HaKuzri by topic. Emuna, Klal Yisrael, Torah, Chachma, Avoda, Karbanos, Tfila, Brachas, Shabbos, Yom Tov, and Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Levi has lots to say about Eretz Yisrael. And then they also have, for each section, this again, Chevron is an interesting yeshiva. For each section, he has selections of Kuzri and poems by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi that correspond to those topics. You just start to get the prose and the poetry. And then at the end, Mangi notes, someone, I guess in Chevron, wrote music, melodies, like put chunks of Yehuda Halevi to song. So like the last couple of pages in the Sefer, they have like sheet music. Very fascinating. I don't know. It's definitely not broadens our sense of what you expect to see in the Chevron Yeshiva. That's for sure. And I will point to so he does have a section on tefillah. We're going to be seeing more. We're sort of seeing the avoda, karbanos, and tefillah, and bracha, sort of like that whole. We're going to see things in context. We're going to see sort of the beginning of my Mishlusha is going to touch on a lot of this. I would turn your attention before we put this away to tomorrow to one last thing, which is on the front page. I told you this was a special topic. How did this copy of this edition of Chatzkel Sarna's reorganized Kuzri end up in the YU library? Let's just read together. Siyat Deshmaya, Aleph Tes Adar Aleph Tavshin Chavzayin. It's Sunday, the 9th of Adar Rishon, in Tavshin Chavzayin, 1967. Teshurah, L'chavod Yedidi Hagon Ha'otzim, a present to my good friend, the incredible Gon. Kavod Taraso Maharid Salvechik. This is a present to my friend, the incredible Gain, the Rav, Yosef Dov Salvechik Shlita, the Rav Kavod Ubracha, Me'es Yedido, from his good friend, Chatzkel Yecheskel, Ben Harav, I'm not sure what his father's name was, Atzal Sarna. So this copy was inscribed by Rav Chatzkel Sarna, by the author, to the Rav. And the Rav apparently, some of his svarim, he donated, a number of apparently his svarim he got, the mail or whatever that he received, he donated to the YU library. So you can find this behind the desk. This is closed shelf in the Gosman library. And it's just like a fascinating piece of history to see the warmth that he didn't need to write this. It wasn't like a journalist asked for Chatzkel Sarna, what do you think of Soloveitchik? This was obviously entirely his own volition, just to get a picture of the warmth and respect that existed at the time. In case you want to look it up, it is 296.174, J92S, closed shelf in the fifth floor of Gosman. Okay, so that's just a little tidbit I thought you would like to see. But again, this sort of gives us a sense of the Sefer HaKuzri, a sense, a little bit of the man. And Yirat Hashem tomorrow, it gives us hopefully a sense of the treat we're going to have in terms of Machshava, in terms of deepening our approach to Tefillah, our understanding of Tefillah and of Avodah, and we'll hopefully we'll not just be in theory, not just in our minds and our hearts and our neshamas, but also in our mouths. We'll practically impact over time the way in which we're Ovid in general, the way in which we are Mispalel in particular. So that we will continue with tomorrow.